Hello, everybody, and welcome to Awakenings. Awakenings is a podcast that invites us all to share a wider story of the human family. We're delighted to be in conversation with leading systems thinkers as we ask ourselves this question as leaders, as people, how do we navigate a crisis of such magnitude that it threatens our existence? What will our legacy be for our human family? We'll be looking at the roots, really, of how we ended up here, in the context of how we use that learning, this wider story, to help us shape a brighter future, to change the choices that we make for the world that we want to have. I'd very much like to acknowledge our elders, our ancestors, the people who in some ways suffered greatly. But if we can learn from their experiences, we can transform that into something that will light us really forward to a much brighter path. I'd also really like to recognise Foundation Nova Diem for their huge generosity in making this podcast possible. Thank you to all of you, and thank you for listening. Good morning, good afternoon, everybody, wherever you are in the world. It's a great pleasure to bring you another episode of Awakenings. And in this episode, we're looking at Money Jungle. We'll be exploring the roots, if you like, of asking the question, really, can we think beyond a finance system that serves only apex predators? And we'll be exploring the history that has created a structure that really extracts much more than it puts back. And so how can we adjust this system so that we can reshape wealth for a much more equitable world? And I can't think of any better person to be having this conversation with than Paula Kensington. Hello, Paula.
Hi, Cindy. Good to be here, having a conversation with you today.
Yeah, it's fantastic to have you, Paula. And Paula is the founder of PK Advisory, has an incredible history working in commercial finance, you know, really working at the coal face of how this money moves around our organization and our lives. Her work always centers around performance that includes outcomes for all stakeholders, including the obvious ones and those which are sometimes left behind, such as earth and nature. So she's exploring the measures that matter to each of us in business and as individuals so that you can look at how to balance this performance with passion, compassion, and a whole new way, really, of looking at success. So really delighted to have you with us, Paula, and to explore this pioneering work that you're doing.
Thank you.
I mean, it's so nice. It's lovely to be in the conversation. I mean, obviously, I've got a lot of questions for you. I just wondered if there's anything that you might like to ask me, really, in terms of the frame for, you know, why we're here today, the purpose of this podcast that really enables us to uncover the roots of how we got here so that we can build a pathway to a brighter world.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Cindy. And I think, you know, it's probably not something that you can answer in a small soundbite such as this podcast, but you know, maybe we can explore some of the background and the impacts that colonization has had on our financial systems, accepting of course that it's multidimensional and complex. But you know, I think you and I have spoken about that. Is there some background that, you know, you could sort of share with the listeners on how you know, believe that the colonization has really led us down the pathway and the challenge that we're in from the climate and, you know, part of that financial system?
Yeah, well, thanks for acknowledging how complex it is, Paula, but I think it is. I think in looking at how we got here, the answers lie to how we get away. So I'll try to do that succinctly. I mean, the climate crisis is the result, really, of the relentless pursuit of private interests by multinational corporations and very powerful countries. You can go as far back as when the Bank of England was established in 1694. It had a really fundamental role to play in enabling Britain to increase its role in the slave trade. It went from lagging behind Spain and Portugal to becoming the most powerful slave trading nation on earth. And that was because of the development of long-term commercial credit. The wealth that came in from the slave trade enabled Britain to engage in multiple wars during the 18th century. And a lot of those wars were really, most of them actually, all of them were around securing more slave colonies. And you get industries that grow up around that, such as mines, shipping, guns. So you're really laying this foundation for this very extractive and very war-based economy, which is something that we really do have to look at in terms of developing a peaceful and thriving way forward, let alone the inherent racism that obviously comes with that system, which has enabled so many people to be far less valued and countries far less valued. You know, it's the West is rich, really, because the rest are poor. And you've got resource extraction, which was begun by through the slave days. And then that just as an empire building developed, it was just about systematic exploitation by European powers who took wealth created from Africa, from America, and placed restrictions on those continents' capacity to make the use of its own economic potential. So these colonized countries are really being hugely underdeveloped. They have no ownership of the means of production. That is most, you know, that's under colonization, it's foreign owned. And as independence comes, that remains in place. So chocolate companies, won't name any chocolate companies, tire companies, the major corporations operating in those, let's look at Africa in particular, are still foreign owned or really around the world. And they're draining the resources out of these countries. So you can't understand poverty and how we solve it. You know, one of the UN SDGs without understanding the historical forces that created it. And then I guess we have something which loosely, it's a soundbite you could call stealing then lending. So you've got the post-war institutions that grow up like the IMF and the World Bank, and they really enable the continuation of this exploitation under the guise of development and investment. These countries were left completely underdeveloped and struggled economically post-independence. And so you've got the IMF, whose five original shareholders were the US, Britain, France, and Germany, and they provided loans, although they came with huge conditions attached, often they called them structural readjustment, and that restricted the government, that those governments' ability to spend on public services, so that you've got no social welfare network, that's all trimmed back. What they could spend it on was foreign countries investing in their country. So they're getting money that's really been, they're being lent money that was made out of the extraction from those companies, and then they're being lent it back to spend on these countries again. So there's no real wealth coming into their countries. They're just ending up in debt bondage, really. It is a very complex issue, and perhaps it will come up later. But that's been a really, you know, really difficult. The World International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have consistently harmed the countries they've claimed to help because of this structural adjustment. And you can even, you know, countries like Pakistan just last year after that flooding, its economy was in free fall. It secured a £3 billion bailout from the IMF. And since 1958, it's entered into 22 agreements with the IMF, and its debt has now reached 7.6 billion. So it's incredibly hard for countries to develop in a way that will enable them to solve, you know, to put in the mitigation, to put in the infrastructure to solve the climate crisis, while all their money is going out in debt. As you very kindly said, it's a very complex issue, but I hope that gives a little overview of some of the kind of pillars that put us in this really tricky, you know, financial architecture.
Yeah, thank you. It's a great kind of opening thought provocation as well, you know, very much from the accounting profession, the body that I'm a member of, ACCA, which is one of the global largest accounting bodies, you know, its reason for being is being a source of public good. So, you know, I do wonder whether the accounting profession globally really is standing up to its moral compass around, are we doing enough for the public good? And I think, you know, you bring some visibility to this, and that's really important. You know, I think from the personal perspective, but also a systemic perspective, you know, what do you think, why do we need to see and confront this history, which is obviously disturbing history of colonization?
Well, you know, thanks, Paul. And I think you make a really good point there. You know, the accounting profession, it's there to serve, it's there to do, you know, public good. And I think, you know, most people want to get up in the morning and do a job where you feel that you've left the world a better place, you know, than because you've done your job. And I think that's that moment, you know, with the little difference reasons why we choose work, but the most fulfilling work is work that is contributing to our society. So I think it's really important because some of the structures make it really hard for that to happen because they're bigger than us. Sometimes we take them so much for granted that they're so embedded. It's almost like fish in water. You can't see the water. So you're getting up to do your job, you know, to do this good, but it's embedded in a system which is really working to continue the extraction and the extractive practices that are fueling our demise. You know, rich countries still rely on a net appropriation of resources from the global south. The drain from the south is worth over $10 trillion a year in northern prices. Southern losses outstrip their aid receipts by a factor of 30. So you're getting this money, but it's going out with the losses. And it's just such an unequal exchange. So it's a major driver of underdevelopment and global inequality. So it's something that we really need to know about so that we can start. And I know, you know, so excited about the work that you're doing. So that if we don't know that that's what is our water, if you like, it's very hard to change the direction that we're they're swimming. I mean, there's staggering statistics. Just Africa received 1.61 billion in loans, African countries did, and 2.3 billion were taken out of Africa in corporate profits. So these numbers just don't add up. If you like, you know, attempts have been made to see how much money came out during the slave trade from the Caribbean. That's been estimated at 7.5 trillion, 2.5 million a year that in the 18, and today is billions a year in Indian money was flowing out of India into UK. So it's terribly hard for these countries. They've got to catch up. They're doing things wrong. They've got to develop. But when they're starting from a baseline of such extraction, and now as a human family, every organization, every company that is part of ensuring our ability to thrive. So I think if we're aware of this in our financial structures, then we have the power to actually adjust them and to do something about them and to address that chronic imbalance.
Yeah, I mean, I think you talked there about education and awareness. And I think, you know, I love what you said about structures being bigger than us, you know, and I really get a sense of that in the financial world and in the world of commercial business, that, you know, we're operating in structures that are bigger than us and really difficult to sort of turn around. So I think shining a light on the issue and education is a really important area to start on, certainly from my perspective. But from you first, you know, you're obviously passionate around this earth-led education and how we change our relationship to nature and earth and the future. And what are the entanglements? Can you talk to us a bit more around those entanglements between colonization, our financial systems, and codes of practice and climate change efforts?
Yeah, well, thanks again, Paula. I think it is, you know, my passion for earth-led education is about seeing us thrive as a human family. You know, I really think human beings get bad press. I think we're a really fantastic group of people. And as you've said, these structures have kind of, you know, there is this dominant, the dominator narrative. We talked about it in the last podcast on what's happened to women, but it's a dominator narrative that's driving everything. It's this, you know, vector of power and winning and greed that's thrown everything out of alignment. There has to be a balance. Yes, we need to understand. I mean, so we really need to reevaluate what does success look like? You know, we've got success looking like a handful of men who own 62% of global wealth. You know, that cannot be a success story if we're to find the mechanisms to enable everybody to make their best effort in mitigating climate change. But that's an end game of a system that is designed for the few to get the maximum. And over the years, it's very short, actually, 400 or 500 years in terms of the existence of Earth, 4.6 billion years, or the existence of the human species, you know, the modern humans, 300,000 years. So it's a terribly short period that we've gone completely out of, out of alignment. So I think it is entirely possible to recalibrate. You know, we're a young species. We're kind, I should imagine, you know, in some ways you could say it's the terrible twos. We're experimenting, but that just simply doesn't work because there's just no more resources for every, for that, that elite group to win. The whole system collapses. So I think it's incredibly, you know, without blame, without, you know, without fear, it's incredibly important to understand that system that we work in, because in there lies the solutions. But when people talk about reparation or debt jubilees or loss and damage, they don't make sense to a lot of people because they don't have the history, even immigration. So climate colonization is almost like climate apartheid on an international scale. It's access to resources is determined by how communities can respond to climate impacts. But if you haven't got access to resources, you can't respond. So we're going to go through a very ugly phase where, you know, a lot of humans are in a, you know, a really desperate situation, and others will be looking like they're doing better for a while. But unless that model is adjusted, it just does not add up. The maths just don't add up. And in understanding how we got there, these countries are, you know, when we talk about climate apartheid, that the countries that don't have access to the resources, that is the history of slavery, of colonization and imperialism that enriched some countries at the expense of others. And global warming has exacerbated these inequalities, and the climate crisis will lead to new divisions between those who can mitigate its impacts and those who cannot. But we need all of us to be able to mitigate our impact. So it's really important to understand that systemically so that we can understand how to redistribute resources, change policies, and the institutions that have put these in place, rather than just handing out a bit of money in terms of reparations and apologies for wrongdoing. It's structurally based, rebalancing so that everybody has this ability to mitigate what we're facing. And then that really does show up in the coming wave of climate refugees. You wouldn't have migration due to climate change if the effects from the global south of the consumption of the global north wasn't hammering the global south. So even by regulating our consumption, you regulate the effects, which stop this, you know, this really awful global issue that we're seeing, which we're not equipped to respond to. It's creating so much polarization and so much hatred, really, division between people, because there's not a systemic understanding of what's happening. And without that, you can't really see what the solutions are, which isn't, you know, that certain parts of the world are very overcrowded. People want to get out. But if you can actually stabilize people's, give people around the world the ability to live in functioning societies, you know, have the ability to mitigate the climate change impacts, you know, you end that warehousing of refugees and this horrible increase of migration from the, you know, which is being so poorly received. So a historically informed response to climate migration would really enable and oblige Western states to grapple with their role in creating the crisis. That's why I think it's so critical that we know that.
Mm. Yeah, you've touched on a lot in such a short space of time already. And, you know, I think consumption is a really critical issue, not just for us as individuals and for us as businesses and for us as countries, as us as a planet. As you said, you know, it's insanity to think that we can have endless growth on a planet that has finite resources. I mean, you know, the work of Kate Raworth is very, and you know, the work of the Stockholm Resilience Stockholm Resource Centre talks about, you know, the planetary boundaries and the social boundaries. But, you know, I think from a finance perspective, you touched on a couple of things there around growth. And I'm really passionate to think about growth and when is enough enough? Because, you know, as a finance professional, I guess my education and my upbringing in the finance world was all about growth is good. And if you're not growing, you're dying. And it's almost like our growth is actually killing us, you know? So actually the reverse was true from everything that I was being told and everything I was operating within. So yeah, maybe we can unpack that a little bit more later.
Yeah. Well, I would love to, Paula. I mean, I hope I've given a kind, you know, a very potted overview of, you know, of some of the issues that have brought us here. But what's so delightful about having you with us this morning is that you've got, you're really working on these incredibly pioneering and brilliant solutions, which is, you know, it's all very well to acknowledge where we're at and how we got here, but how do we get out is probably the most exciting and important question that we can ask ourselves. So can you give me an overview of your work at PK Consulting and its purpose? And, you know, how can it help us be more aware of the issues that I've covered, our past, or how we formed our worldview and our consideration of value in personal and organizational practices today? I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, thanks, Cindy. So I've been out on my own for 5 years and doing that PK advisory CFO on demand, if you like, for smaller businesses that don't have a finance professional. And in that exploration of helping smaller businesses, I've started to take a step back and think to myself, well, what is the purpose? What is my role as a finance professional in the world? And I guess, you know, maybe it was my age as well as coming out of the corporate workforce that suddenly realized that there was more to success than just a salary and, you know, a role, prestige, and, you know, all of these things that I thought were important, kind of then realized in the last 5 years that were actually less important. And it's more about how do we do better business from all stakeholders' perspectives. Because as you said, when you introduced me, you know, it's all well and good to have shareholders, but, you know, we're operating in a system, as you say, and a whole web of people and non-people that we're impacting positively and negatively. So I guess in the last couple of years, I've started to push my thinking to what does doing better business look like? And that sort of pushed me towards more than sustainability. Because if we think about sustainability and the finance profession, really late to this party, right? So you talk about awareness and education, but the finance community, I think, are about 10 years behind where the rest of the world are in terms of their thinking and the impact that we're having. Some other people think that I'm being too generous and actually we're almost 20 years behind. But yeah, and so we're expecting the finance community to do better, but there's no frameworks, there's no impetus other than personal passion to do better. There's no kind of frameworks to do better. I mean, it's taken probably the best part of 6 years to get a first international sustainability standard launched globally. I mean, and we can't wait for another 6 years for the next one, you know, so we've got to do something. And I think that's what I've picked up the baton to bring about different conversations within the finance community globally. And I started doing that around my own investigation around what actually could it look like? What does stewardship mean? What is a nested system? You know, again, that wasn't part of my education. So, you know, if we talk about not wanting to point the blame at anybody, but when you're not exposed to that education, it makes it really hard to challenge what you're being told, right? So as a busy finance professional, who's got the time to go off and do their personal investigation into what does the system look like that I'm operating in? So again, that was new for me, and I'm sure it will be new for a lot of people who haven't studied it or being part of it, even though obviously we are part of a whole system. So that's the work I've been doing. And I guess how that's showing up is in a number of different ways. I'm talking about challenging the models, challenging the messages, challenging the language of the finance professional. And so, you know, we're a funny bunch because we, you know, have our own language and we understand each other, and we can be a little untrusting of others. Often, you know, people like to sort of stick in there in a tribe of who they know because, you know, you get each other and you speak the same language. So there's this kind of global tribe of finance professionals, and hopefully they see me as a credible voice to actually challenge everything that I was told in the last 35 years was true, and actually it might not be true, or there might be a different version of the truth.
Well, that's absolutely fascinating, Paula, and it's such an inspirational and really powerful story because, you know, something did connect with you that you were able to see this much bigger picture of the system that we're in. I had the great good fortune to see Kate Raworth. You mentioned Kate Raworth present a couple of days ago, and she showed that moment when there's the map of Earth that Ptolemy has put forward, and there's Earth in the centre with the sun and the other planets going around it, and there's Copernicus on the other side going, uh-oh, you know, it's completely the other way around, and he has to wait for his moment in time to be able to say that. And then it comes and it flips the way that we understand ourselves here right on the head, in the same way that you're talking about the financial system. I think Kate said that death in the living world is an externality in economics rather than, you know, the living world being at the heart of any system that we design, because that's our life support system. So, you know, really powerful, really inspiration. You somehow engaged with this. You heard a different story. How can an individual or an organization engage with this incredible work that you're doing to be part of creating a more regenerative future personally and systemically? Now, do you have to start from scratch, or can you start from where you are? What does it actually involve?
Yeah, so I've set up over the last 24 months a CFO conversation online. This year, I'm calling it the Future Finance Thinkers Hub. And it's about bringing finance thinkers together, about talking about some of the systemic challenges, some of the meta crisis that we find ourselves in, and to sort of, you know, soundboard where everyone's at. So we've got, you know, different countries. So last month I had a conversation, and I think I had representatives from about 10 different countries and probably different industries. And I think that's, you know, we've got to come up with different thinking. So we can't solve, you know, the problems with the same thinking that kind of brought them about. So I sort of hold space for people to think about what might be some of the answers. And so that's a real way to engage with me and the community through conversation. I've also, as I say, written two papers. So if this is a topic that's, you know, quite new, which it will be for a lot of finance people, I've written two papers. I call them green papers instead of white papers for a bit of fun. But I wrote those for two reasons. One, to sort of solidify my understanding, because there's nothing better than writing about something rather than just continually reading about something. To actually then write about it means there's a certain level of understanding that you've reached yourself. But then secondly, it's about trying to give a sense of what opportunities might exist to finance professionals. Because as I said before, nobody's got the time to dive into rabbit holes that I've been diving into in the last 5 years. You know, the CFO's got a job to do already. They don't need another job at the weekend and after hours to do that. So if I can synthesize some of that into paper, then, you know, that might make easier reading. And also, as a finance professional, people need to see, show me what's been happening in other case studies so that I can understand. You know, it's very hands-on, you know, and I think that's a lot of how finance professionals like to think. I want to kind of do, and I want to see what others have done. And so making it real. So I think those are ways to engage with me. I'm also working with two purpose-led entities, one that's exploring earth equity. So that's the Earth Equity Network, where we talk about valuing, equaling the value out, and how do we think about bringing in new systems to bring, you know, regenerative to people and place as well. And then I'm also part of another business that's looking at future value and how to recognize that. So it's all about impact and making sure that we consider the impact that we're having and recognizing that, and how do we do better. But yeah, hopefully that's answered a little bit about how to engage with me.
Yeah, I mean, that's when it's just every time I speak to you, Paula, I'm just more and more impressed, because you are really developing this new framework with huge skill and expertise, and you've got the generosity or just the sense that we are so interconnected, that you're sharing it right across the profession so that you can accelerate how everybody moves forward. I think that's just, you know, it's just a whole different way of thinking. Most people are so competitive. If they have something, they keep it themselves, you know, but you're actually sharing this so the whole industry can move forward, which is, you know, hugely impressive and laudable, and gives me great hope that we can actually make a shift in the time that we have left to do so. So you're forging ahead and transforming the finance profession from inside without waiting for the rules and the regulations to catch up with what our world needs, which, as you point out, might well be too late. So it really is groundbreaking and brilliant work.
I
and
think
it has
also, huge... I think also, if I can just add there, that I've also gone back to the accounting profession and just sort of given them a little scratch as well and said, like, are you actually moving fast enough here? Because I think sometimes when you're an individual, you can actually see change and you can see pockets of change happening. When you're a big organization, you kind of get lost in the whole system of being a big organization. You kind of don't see all these emerging opportunities. So I'll give you an example. So in the accounting profession, you know, obviously very driven around, you know, governance and reporting, but you know, we've now got ecosystems popping up around how to account for impact. So the accounting profession aren't really thinking yet in this way, but this agile ecosystem has been born out of some of the business schools and some of that regenerative thinking and beyond sustainability. And they're thinking about what is the impact? How can we measure it? And how do we bring it to our ledgers? How do we bring it into our reporting? And yet the accounting profession almost have lost, not lost sight, but they're not moving fast enough to even be part of this new ecosystem. So I actually think some of the accounting profession is in overwhelm because they're not able to move fast enough, whereas some of other people can, you know. I think there's changing happening, but anyway, that's
it's really exciting. That was another one of my takeaways from Kate Raworth's presentation, that the economic models that we have, the finance, the accounting models do not serve, that we're still using models that were developed, you know, 100 years ago. So we're just not able to. And that's the first rule of economics is, you know, use a model that serves the time that you're in now. So this sounds really fantastic. And it's got this huge potential to shift the fundamentals of this economic model that was forged in an era, a colonial era, that no longer even the purpose of maximizing profits, doing that is the key driver of our collapse. So on which those profit on the economic and the social and the environmental stability on which those profits depend. So, you know, again, how did you come to evolve this model and how do you plan to get it to work in the wider world? And obviously, most importantly, how can we be part of supporting that? Because it's clearly critical that this is taken up widely and that this shift can happen at scale.
Yeah, thanks, Cindy. I think something landed for me about a year ago when I was talking to, I had a regenerative coach thinking partner. So I needed someone to challenge my thinking around, you know, what I didn't know as well. So when I was talking to her, I said to her, like, what costs and who are we not bringing into our spreadsheets? And that kind of really resonated with me when I suddenly, it was almost like I channeled this thought, like, who's not in our spreadsheet? And it's almost like breathing that fresh air into our balance sheet. Isn't that a wonderful kind of idea of having all this fresh air in a stale balance sheet? So I'm thinking about evolving this model and, you know, there's external models and then there's internal models from a business perspective. So from an external model, you're thinking about, you know, the investors and the value. And if you're a listed business, like, you know, the value that the market has deemed that you're worth, assuming that, you know, there's no cost or value being brought in for any of the commons and any of the extraction or exploitation that's going on, like none of that's actually coming into the financial ledger. So let's put that to one side. But so there's this external system that says, you know, these are the models and these are your values and this is how we measure you. And then there's this internal heartbeat of the organization that then every decision that's made is made on a business case. So, you know, if you want to spend $1 million, you have to go to the CFO and say, I want to spend this $1 million. And they say, well, show me the business case. But like you say, it's all based on models that are so out of date that how could we possibly bring in some fresh air, some new breath into those business cases? Like, how do we bring in the cost of impact of nature? How do we bring in, you know, the damage or the improvements that we're making when we go into an area and we sort of, you know, make it better or worse in when we're doing something in our service or our product? So how do we bring that into our balance sheet and business cases. And something that again landed for me was some of the measures, you know, like we take this percentage, we take a discounted rate. We say that this $1 million is going to be worth less now than, you know, than in 5 years time because of the cost of money, let's say. So, you know, here we are discounting this value to today's money, but who's to say we should be compounding it? Like, if we spend $1 million today and actually it's doing good and we're saving, you know, the land use, or we're restoring the forest, and we're putting back all the biodiversity that we've taken out, like, isn't that $1 million actually worth 10 million? Mm. Like, so wouldn't yeah. we totally flip the model yeah. and say it's actually worth more than not less? So all of that thinking has to be challenged. And questioning everything that I learned. So there's this internal, external pressure. And I think in some ways, the international sustainability standards is going to help, but maybe I think overall it's going to help. But, you know, I think the worry is that certain jurisdictions only want to pick and choose the parts of that standard that they're going to be able to manage, Australia being one of them. So, you know, potentially we're just going to go into the climate issue of the standard and not the whole sustainability standard. So that means then that you get this kind of green standard from Australia's perspective, whereas the rest of the world has to report to this gold standard. So, you know, it's a bit challenging that, you know, you're sort of trying to transition to doing better business. And it's going to have some challenges that, you know, could have been avoided if Australia just said, you know what, we're going to put the big girl pants on and we're actually going to roll out the whole standard. Let's not pick and choose because it's easy or easier. Let's just hold ourselves to the highest standard. Like, why wouldn't we?
Yeah. I mean, that sounds absolutely, you know, you're 100% right. It's that people are still very reluctant. It's again, that's why it's so important to understand the why these changes need to happen and the how we got there, so that you can actually understand that really you're taking the biggest risk by not doing something about it, rather than, you know, that fear that holds a lot of people back. So how are you working with that, Paula, and really trying to get this into, because I can see, I mean, it's for me, it makes perfect sense. It's absolutely brilliant. But I can see systemically that must be quite hard when you're asking people to do this Ptolemy flip, if you like, and see and value the world so differently. So how are you getting this out into the wider world, and how can we support you in that?
Yeah, different ways. I mean, I'm working with purpose-led businesses that get this, that understand, and they want to see the change happen as well. So that's beautiful, because then it, you know, you're not trying to preach to the converted, that, you know, these people get you. And so some of that's happening. I mean, I think if people want to try and get involved, as I said, to reach out to me and be part of the conversation, you know, also I think we have to speak to the investment community to get them to fund some of this really important work yeah. around how do we think about this. So, you know, I'm at the moment busy trying to build a regenerative index, and, you know, and we might want to go and get funding for that. So that would be awesome
yeah.
to actually start thinking about, oh, how do we raise funding for that? I mean, this is all yeah. happening in simultaneous to the own personal tension of, you know, of me having to earn money, you know, to keep my lights on, to keep, you know, the food on the table, whilst you're still trying to push the boundaries of the system that you're operating in. So it's, yeah, it's quite a challenging and exciting way of yeah. living.
I mean, like, I hope that won't be the situation. You're such a powerful voice, Paula, and you've got the, you know, as you say, I mean, that the work that you're doing is, you know, I hope that people, that listeners out there, if they want to fund Paula's work so it can be developed more quickly, it's clearly utterly critical. So I think, you know, I think you are leading, you know, you are a really powerful leader. I think that's wholly apparent. And I think, you know, what you're, I hoped to see next time you're on the podcast, you'll be carrying your award services to the accounting industry and to all of us as a human family. It's been absolutely delightful to have you on Awakenings this morning, Paula. You certainly are awakening a whole sector there. And, you know, it's such a privilege to have you in our ecosystem. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Cindy. Thank you for inviting me and being part of this conversation. I feel like we're just getting going, so I can't wait to come back.
Yeah, absolutely. Me too. Thanks again, Paula. You've been listening to the Awakenings podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please do share the podcast, and you can visit my website. It's www.cindyford.com. I'd like to thank everybody who's been part of this, our wonderful systems thinkers who have joined us, and I'd really like a special thanks to go to Foundation Nova Diem, who've made this podcast possible. It's been such a pleasure to share this time with you. Thank you so much for listening.